Hi, this is Katya, executive producer of On the Media. So this week in Chicago, Bob accepted an award on behalf of the whole team from the National Alliance for Media Literacy Education. While there, he sat down with former FCC chairman Newton Minow for a wide-ranging discussion about media in the Kennedy era, the takeover of social media, and an anecdote involving Gilligan's Island. Here's Bob at the conference introducing Mr. Minow.
I'm here to introduce you to the only chairman in the 83-year history of the Federal Communications Commission whom you can name, except maybe for Robert E. Lee, but he wasn't the Robert E. Lee, so he doesn't count. Newton Minow has a long, long and distinguished career in public service and law. He was the 2016 recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And these are kind of hard to come by, although under current circumstances, I think Ted Nugent is next on the list. Mr. Minow is a genuine visionary. He, among other things, is the reason why when televisions had tuning dials, there was a second one for UHF. The opening of that spectrum, among other accomplishments, enabled PBS to grow from coast to coast. Sometimes Mr. Minow the visionary's vision was kind of bleak. He is most famous for Tuesday, May 9th, 1961, when he spoke to the National Association of Broadcasters and informed them that their accumulated efforts had created a vast wasteland, barren of redeeming civic value. The NAB calls that day Black Tuesday, but the speech was later characterized by one commentator as the Gettysburg Address of broadcasting. 56 years later, is it? Those words still resonate and indeed have a place next to "Ask not what your country can do for you" and "I have a dream" as the most enduring rhetoric of the post-war era. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Newton Minow. I want to start with the obvious subject. The Ossie and Harriet show was on TV when you were the commissioner. Am I correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And I believe you're acquainted with Ricky Nelson.
Yes.
All right. Well, he went on to become a teen sensation, kind of a heartthrob, and he had songs like "Hello, Mary Lou," "Traveling Man," and "I'm Walking." And Ricky Nelson's music career ebbed and flowed, but it just killed him as he made the rounds of venue to venue around the country that all anybody wanted to hear from him was "Hello, Mary Lou," "Traveling Man," and "I'm Walking," instead of his new work. He even wrote a song about that phenomenon, which was called "Garden Party." So my question is, are you Ricky Nelson? Are you sick of the vast wasteland?
No. Well, let me begin first by thanking you for inviting me today. And if you don't listen to Bob's program On the Media, you should. I've listened to it for years, and you learn more about what's good and what's bad and what's true and what's not in On the Media, so be sure to listen.
Thank you. It's very gracious. Thank you. So are you sick of hearing about vast wasteland 56 years ago?
Well, I have to tell you the circumstances of the speech, because I think a great deal about it. This was the same week that the United States launched its first human being into space. Alan Shepard, the first astronaut to go into space. President Kennedy was to speak to the broadcasters the day before I was to speak. And he invited me to join him in driving from the White House to the, what was the Wardman Park Hotel, to give his speech. And I was waiting outside the Oval Office. The president came out and he said, I have Commander Shepard and his wife in my office. What do you think about taking them to the broadcasters convention? I'm going to take them to Congress, but maybe we could go to the broadcasters convention first. I said, that would be perfect. So he said, well, just wait here for me. I'll arrange this. A few minutes later, he came out. He said, it's all arranged. He said, now come with me. I want to change my shirt. And he took me up to the living quarters of the White House. And although I knew the president before he was elected, this was kind of scary for me. And the president was changing his shirt. And he said to me, what do you think I should say to the broadcasters? And I said, it'd be a good idea to compliment the broadcasters on carrying live the broadcast of the launch of Commander Shepard into space, and to talk about the difference between a closed society and an open society. That in Russia, when they do a space shot, nobody knows if it failed, it succeeded. Broadcasters are not allowed there. But in the United States, we invite the broadcasters to cover it so everyone in America can see in a free way what's happening. President Kennedy didn't say that's a good idea or that's a bad idea. He didn't say anything. But the president got to the broadcasters and he said, isn't it marvelous that you broadcasters covered the launch of the space program so that everyone in America could see it? He said, that's the difference between a closed society and an open society. And I'm so grateful to you for enabling all Americans to see it. The president's speech was a huge hit. And then I was there the next day, and they didn't like my speech at all.
Kind of a buzzkill, really.
Yes. Sherwood Schwartz, the creator of Gilligan's Island, didn't like the speech at all. So he named the sinking ship in Gilligan's Island the SSS Minnow, which was the greatest compliment I could have had.
You know, that was going to be my last question. Are you aware of that? All right. We're going to discuss something more, let's say, ongoing, the question of public interest in the broadcaster's role. But I still want to hear a little more Hello, Mary Lou, if you don't mind. When you took the broadcasters to task, lo, those 56 years ago, the week's programming schedule on network TV included The Ed Sullivan Show, General Electric Theater, which was drama, The Andy Griffith Show, The Bell Telephone Hour, teleplays, The Dick Van Dyke Show, Alcoa Premiere, teleplays, and Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color. Today, it is Lethal Weapon, Survivor, Scandal, Crime, I don't know what that is, The Exorcist, Marvel's Inhumans, Law and Order SVU, Law and Order True, Law and Order S&M, Law and Order WTF, Law and Order ISIS. And then there's Cable, which is less vast wasteland than post-apocalyptic hellscape. So you were right, but did your speech, the thing for which you were most remembered, accomplish anything?
Well, but you also now have PBS, you also have HBO, you also have ESPN, you also have TCM. If whatever you are interested in, you have. If you're a sports junkie, you've got plenty of sports on television. If you're a news junkie, you've got news 24/7. If you're a child, you now have programs like Sesame Street. So the main thing I wanted to do was to expand choice, to expand the opportunities for more people to have the opportunity to have television stations and provide a wider range of programming. And I still think today, although I have a lot of trouble with fake news and the things that are happening, I still think that the expansion of choice was the best thing the government should do.
The premise for your original complaint and your ongoing activism is that broadcasters, in exchange for access to the public airwaves, have a civic obligation. But that simple notion of obligation, of a quid pro quo, seems to have disappeared. How did that happen?
Well, when broadcasting began in the United States, we did not do what most other countries did. Most other countries, and that includes England, most of Europe, Japan, Canada, most other countries saw broadcasting as a public service which should be not for profit and in most cases operated by the government. The Japanese in particular studied what was going on in the world in broadcasting. They loved the BBC with the idea that everyone would pay a license fee and there'd be a not-for-profit, no commercial service. They also liked the idea of some things they saw in the United States with a commercial service. So they created a system with both systems. But first, they started with NHK, and in Canada, they started with the CBC. In Britain, they started with the BBC. We started broadcasting in this country during the Depression. And our government policy at that time was to encourage people to invest in what was seen as a very risky venture. So we started it in reverse. We started it with an advertiser-supported system. We forgot about providing a not-for-profit public service system until much later. So we got off on the wrong foot, and during the Kennedy administration, we tried to catch up. I came to the FCC from Chicago. President Kennedy came to the White House from Boston. We each came from a city that had a public television station. We were shocked to learn no public television station in New York, no public television station in Los Angeles, no public television station in Washington, D.C., the capital of the United States. So we had to do catch-up, and today, I'm very proud to say, we now have hundreds of PBS stations throughout the country, and we have hundreds of NPR stations doing public radio as well. But we were doing catch-up, it was the problem.
At one point, commercial broadcasters were obliged to have some sort of public service programming. It usually showed up in the ghetto of 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was some local public affairs show that had a vanishingly small audience, but it was there. And then there was the evening news broadcast, and that fulfilled the obligation. Was there a statutory obligation, or was this kind of an industry convention, a voluntary thing?
It was a policy of the FCC at one point. This was late in the administration of Franklin Roosevelt to require that broadcasters provide some form of public service. That was usually ended up with being the news, which then was a not-for-profit, venture. The news programs usually were provided by the broadcaster as a public service. There was very little regulation, but then in the late 50s, there were scandals in the broadcasting business, scandals in radio with payola.
Quiz shows.
Right. Scandals with television, with the quiz show programs, scandals at the FCC, where President Eisenhower had to fire the then chairman of the FCC. So when I arrived at the job, the beginning of the Kennedy administration, my job was to clean the joint up, clean up the agency itself, the FCC, and the industry. And people have forgotten that. And the speech, in many ways, was intended to get the broadcaster's attention that there was a new sheriff in town and things were not going to be done exactly as they were in the past.
As you mentioned, the biggest category of public service activity was the news. But that has evolved as well. One might almost say mutated. Since the 70s, when broadcasters realized that what they'd been running as a loss leader was actually a potential profit center, and they weren't wrong. What effect did that have, not only on the industry, but just on the body politic?
Well, I noticed when you were introduced this afternoon that you had won the Edward R. Murrow Award. The day I gave that speech, I got two phone calls at home that night. One was from Edward R. Murrow, who then was running the USIA, the United States Information Agency, which runs the Voice of America. And Edward R. Murrow said to me, "You stole my speech." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Didn't you see the speech I gave 2 years ago in Chicago to the radio television news directors?" And I said, "No, I'm sorry, I didn't." He said, "Well, you stole my speech." And I looked at his speech later, and it's true, he gave a better speech than I did, saying the same thing, that there was a public interest obligation that broadcasters had to provide. The other phone call I got was from President Kennedy's father, Ambassador Joseph Kennedy, who called me through the White House and said, "That was the best speech since my son's inauguration speech." He said, "If anybody gives you any problems, you call me. Goodbye." I never heard from him again, but I was flattered. But Edward R. Murrow was standing for the same standard of broadcasting that I was trying to make apply to everybody.
Can you imagine what Murrow would have thought of the Dateline franchise, of cable news, of, well, Fox News Channel in particular, and the ecosystem that has evolved since Rune Arledge or whoever figured out that there's money in them there broadcasts?
Well, I've often thought that maybe I should regret what I did, because who could have foreseen I would have channels who make up the news, who provide fake news, and who don't regard being factual as an obligation. Who could have anticipated that? Years ago, when we watched the news on television or listen to the news on radio, we all got the same common facts. We started with the same understanding of the situation and the problems. Now, a lot of the country starts with a different set of facts. They regard, even we have people in the White House talking about alternative facts. And unless we unite and start with a common set of facts, this country is going to be in big, big trouble.
Yeah, I think it's all your fault, and here's why. You were a champion of choice, of diversity, of a broader palette of options. Unable to imagine, of course, at the time that you would live to see a world where not only could you choose your favorite commentator and your favorite style, you could actually choose your own reality. And you could live in a filter bubble in which you, between your own personal choices and what some algorithm is feeding you based on your previous choices, that you can live in a world that is fundamentally of your own creation, or at least serves your own worldview to the exclusion of anything else.
That's why I accepted the invitation to come here today, because what you are doing is the cure for what has happened with people getting alternative facts.
Excuse me, one second, I'm sorry. I'll ask the questions here. What is the cure for the phenomenon I've just described?
I think we're just developing them. For the most important thing is education. The most important thing is that our children learn how to evaluate what is true and what isn't true. To listen to programs like yours where they understand how the media works, what leads people to perform well or not to perform well. And I think we're just beginning to realize that we're living in a new technological revolution where social media has dominated things. People forget that the iPhone is only 10 years old. 10 years old. But it has transformed America. You go anywhere and all you do is people watching their iPhone, particularly kids. And as a result, we haven't adjusted yet. We have not adjusted yet to reconciling how to find the truth.
The very process of trying to disabuse people of the lies and misinformation they're getting on fake news. I'm not talking about President Trump's version of fake news, which is called news. But when the process of disabusing people of the falsities that they're immersing themselves in merely confirms and validates for them that there are certain elites who are trying to impose their worldview on them. How do you cure the patient if the patient doesn't believe that he's got a disorder?
I think there's only one answer to that, and that's education. And without education, there's no hope.
I'm sorry, I just, sometimes I feel like there's no hope.
Sometimes I feel that way too, but we can't give up.
As we sit here, the dominance of network television has been waning for the last 20 years. First because of cable, and now because of the internet. The technology of delivering content through the airwaves is itself really essentially obsolete. And as cable itself struggles to maintain its own business model, it's entirely possible that the lights will go out altogether, not only in my lifetime, maybe in yours. First, do you agree that the possibility is that broadcasting per se will cease to be broadcasting of content, that is? And then what? Then what happens?
When broadcasting began in our country, the concept was that broadcast signals would go through the air, that telephone calls would go by wire. All the regulation assumed that that was the situation forever. Broadcast signals through the air, telephone calls by wire. What has happened today? Most telephone calls now go through the air. Most broadcasting goes through wire. So there's been a fundamental turnabout in technology, a fundamental turnabout. When cable began, the broadcasters loved it because it was not a competitor. It was carrying a broadcast signal into an area or a building that couldn't receive it over the air. Cable was not doing its own programming. It was not selling advertising. It was extending the broadcast signal. So the broadcasters loved it. Then the cable industry said, well, we don't want to just be extending broadcast signals. We'd like to make money from advertising as well. We'd like to create our own programs. So they became a competitor. So then you had a fight, a raging fight for decades between the broadcasters on one hand, cable industry on the other hand. Copyright issues were involved. Cases went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. Finally, some reconciliation arrived, but in the meanwhile, there was a great extension of cable. What will happen in the future? I don't know. It looks to me that more and more and more will become the social media, internet evolution, that more and more people will get their information, their news, through maybe even some ways we've never even heard of. The basic problem is that technology moves much, much faster than public policy, much, much faster than the law. Now, last week, the United States Supreme Court decided a very important case. It has not gotten the attention, in my judgment, that it should have. This is a case from North Carolina. The state of North Carolina passed a law that said that anyone who was convicted as a sex offender could be excluded from access to social media to send messages which might reach children that end up with some kind of sexual offense. They justified that on the same basis that laws exist that require sex offenders to register where they live and so on. The man who was excluded from access to social media said, no, I have rights under the First Amendment. And he went to court. And the United States Supreme Court last week said by a vote of 9-0, unanimously, you cannot stop someone from having access to social media. That social media is where the world is, depriving anyone of access violates the First Amendment. So the United States Supreme Court has said in social policy that anything goes.
We are increasingly living our lives in social media, on wireless, through devices that right now hold in our hands. It may someday be just wearing them on our heads, or someday actually possibly having them implanted. This requires bandwidth. And let's just say that vision of the end of broadcast of content goes away because it's outlived its usefulness. That's a lot of spectrum. That's a lot of broadcast spectrum. You have a notion of using that spectrum as a kind of organ donation, not the kidneys and corneas of the dead industry, but the bandwidth. How would that work out, and what would it be used for?
Well, the FCC today is encouraging broadcasters, particularly they made the offer to a public television broadcaster to give up their channels because the wireless community telephone want that spectrum, and to give up their channels in exchange for money and to operate without using the spectrum. It may be that the whole idea we started with broadcasting through the air, it may be that that's going to end. If I want to hear your program and I miss when it's broadcast, I can now get it on my iPhone. So it may be that people, at my convenience, not at the time it was broadcast. So it may be we're going to move toward that kind of a system. I hope not. I hope not. But I think, again, the technology is what's driving things.
You know, this was the point where I was going to let you tell your Sherwood Schwartz story about the minnow, but you stepped on that joke. Let me ask you one last thing. We're having this conversation at a particular historic moment where the convergence of a number of factors, the culture wars, the economy, social media, the fragmentation, the hyper-fragmentation of media as we've always known it, has yielded a kind of a rogue presidency. Now, you've said that you believe the solution for penetrating the filter bubble and identifying fake news is education. Now, I could be a jerk and say, well, to extend that thought, then this audience has not done a good enough job because a whole lot of people have been bamboozled because they don't even know, we were discussing this earlier, don't even fundamentally understand that when they're reading a story on Facebook, to know that the source is a source beyond Facebook. So you could argue that these people just, they haven't made a big enough impression. But really, it's that the notion of media literacy itself is not all that universally accepted. We are so focused in education on STEM, science, technology, engineering, math, that we've kind of neglected, you know, at least one generation of kids. Is the society ready for this group to do what it should do to make sure that we never find ourselves in these political circumstances again?
Well, media literacy, the idea of teaching media literacy is still new. It may have gone on for a generation, but it did not penetrate the masses. It has not penetrated the culture in a deep way. And all it means is you guys have got to do more. You got to enlist more people to do what you're doing. And I don't know if you quote me correctly. I don't know any alternative in education. But that means that there have to be more educators doing a better job.
So, more of y'all. I want to thank you very much. Mr. Minow, it has been one of the great honors and pleasures of my career to talk to you. Thank you very much, and thank all of you.
That was Bob Garfield interviewing former FCC Chairman Newton Minow at the National Alliance for Media Literacy Education Conference in Chicago this week. Tune in for the big show on Friday. Thanks.